Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, Happy New Year to everyone, and I wanted to start off the new year announcing a new feature. It's going to be showing up on the website in the resources in over the next couple of weeks. I have found a couple of really good YouTube channels for visual education. I know I talk about some really complicated stuff sometimes, genetics, epigenetics, and etc. So it's sometimes challenges even my powers to try and describe what's going on here at the molecular level. And I found some really good sites that do that really well. So I'll be posting some annotated YouTube videos just to kind of walk you through what you're looking at and also help you refer back to something. If I'm talking about it on the show, I might be able to just say, oh, if you've got your computer handy, you can go look at this video while you're listening to this, and suddenly maybe it'll make a little bit more sense. I promised last week that I would bring you a retrospective of 2019, and so I am. I also have a few looking forward stories and answers to a lot of really excellent emails, so we'll be jumping to those a little while, but first let's start out with just kind of rewinding the most important science stories of 2019, science health. And so please, if it's about a new particle being discovered, that's great, but it's outside of my ballywax. So probably the most important thing was the announcement just a few days ago that Jian Kuai, the doctor, He Jian Kuai is the name of the doctor who, PhD, I should say, the scientist who was found guilty of illegally carrying out genetic manipulation of embryos for the purpose of reproduction. This is important. Actually, he was convicted of practicing medicine without a license, and that's very important. First of all, kind of hard to miss this story. There's this thing called CRISPR, which acts as a genetic cut and paste. It was discovered in 2013. The world community has deliberately not gone after germ lines, that is to say, creating new babies with this technology. They've gone into people's bone marrows. They're trying to cure various cancers. But everybody's really clear that creating something that's going to breed true through the species when that individual grows up and has kids is probably more than we should be doing. Well, yeah, it's a crime of major proportions, a crime against humanity, in my opinion. And the guy got a 3-year term, essentially, for practicing medicine without a license. This is not a good precedent. These babies were born. They exist. They are now human beings on the planet. And they are also an experiment. The experiment didn't actually go all that well. The technique was not carried out as precisely as it might have been. He didn't quite get the effect he wanted. Oh, yeah, he disabled the gene he was trying to disable, but he disabled it in a different place. And this is a gene, that substance that's on every single white blood cell of a certain type, the TH4 cell, in the body. We don't know what the long-term implications with respect to the development of leukemia, with the development of autoimmune disease. We have no idea what he's done, because what he was trying to reproduce was a natural mutation which occurred and which is apparently without any negative downside. It's just a positive mutation that makes you immune to HIV. Well, we're not really sure he did that. The fact that he got such a short prison term and the fact that he did it at all is very bad news for the world, because in places that are not seeing the light of day, the light of publicity, in countries that are perhaps in more of a command and control situation than our own, it's not just designer babies, it's designer people. And I can't I've lost count of the number of science fiction scenarios. So that was the big one. Let's go to some of what happened in the year. Let's start with an article that I, well, two stories, actually. One is June 19th and the other is September 1st. They both relate to vaping disease. June 19th, June 2nd show, was when I made an initial warning about vaping and children, and also concerns about the other ingredients that were in the vape products. Less than 3 months later, the first deaths were reported, and we had an epidemic of fulminant pulmonary failure, pretty much the same thing that happens when you get mustard gas or when you have a near-death experience and go into shock and your lungs bleed fluid and fill with fluid and you effectively drowned in your own secretions. Yeah, not a pretty death. Well, now we've got quite a few of them, and the numbers keep going up because there were a lot of these happening under the radar in people who were older and vaping tobacco products, not marijuana products, heavy tobacco vapors who were just thought, well, they died. You know, they got pneumonia and they died. No, they actually didn't. They died of the same thing. It's only when we had this massive bump in young people, particularly young men, that was so out of the ordinary that we figured out that we actually had a new disease on our hand. I just got an announcement from the local public health department telling me once someone's been discharged from a vaping illness like this, they have a hugely increased risk of death. And I'm going to have to be monitoring them carefully for, well, until further notice, which probably means forever. Another story, this one on March 24th, kind of a good one. Hyperbaric oxygen was shown to improve old brain injury. That means a stroke that might be 2 or 3 years old, a person who had a severe head trauma from an IED. Hyperbaric oxygen actually works to regrow new neurons and new synapses. And this is a bit of new information that opens up a beacon of hope for so many people out there. I look forward to seeing an expansion of hyperbaric oxygen technology. By the way, you do need the solid tanks, not the ones you can buy online. You need the ones that go up to 3 atmospheres. But the fact that we can do this late is just huge. In April 14th, we had a story about the March of the Monoclonals, particularly a new drug called ianalumab for migraine. This drug is a monoclonal, that is to say an antibody that attacks something called calcitonin-related peptide, and will gene peptides, calcitonin-related gene peptide. And the drug is spelled ERENUMAB. In fact, we have an email about it, which I'll be getting to later in the program. Exactly, precisely. Recapping what I said in April with more detail now, because I've had a chance to do more reading about why this drug is a bad idea. And this certainly was the year of the keto. We had lots of conversations about that in May, the 5th and the 13th. Keto diets have been really big, really fashionable, really Instagrammable this year, and they are a problem. We talked about why, and research continues to come out. In June of 2030, we talked about the Kind Bar versus Clif Bar cage match, which was quite fun. And in July, on July 24th, if you go back to the Ask Dr. Dawn show and look in the archives, these are the dates. Not the date the show aired, but the date that it is posted in the archives. So, biomarker for chronic fatigue was found. That means if you have, let's say, chronic fatigue and you maybe think it's chronic Lyme, or your doctor thinks it's mixed connective tissue disease, or somebody or your other doctor thinks it's depression, there is a biomarker that shows that, no, this really is chronic fatigue. And that is huge for a whole bunch of people who have been written off as just mental when they're really suffering from a physiological illness. On August 25th, we talked about Scott and Mark Kelly, the two astronauts. One stayed on Earth, like the little piggy who stayed home, and the other little piggy went to Mars. And the epigenetic changes between the two were studied by NASA, and the story broke in August, and it's fascinating. In November, we talked about a new medical specialty that had just become official. It is people who specialize in treating internet gaming disorder. It's a growth industry, folks. Little spas out there, tucked off into rural America, where you go to detox from your gaming problem. So funny. This was so predictable. Back in the 90s, my husband gave a speech, I believe it was in San Francisco, to the American Psychological Association, and he talked about internet addiction. Way back in the 90s, we were already thinking this was going to be a thing. In one last one, November 17th, brought the arrival of the smart toilet, a toilet which is able to perform real-time organic acid testing, not just telling you if you're diabetic, but also telling you all sorts of interesting things about your nutrition and your physiology, probably detecting diseases when they are preclinical and easily treated as well, coming to a high-end plumbing store near you. And for those of you who are science fiction buffs, I highly recommend the series Orcs and Crake. This is a three-part series, I believe, but it begins with a woman trapped in a post-apocalyptic world and having a conversation with her smart toilet. So it's always amazing to see when science fiction becomes reality. On to our first email. This from Dan in Baltimore. Hi, Dr. Don. I was interested to learn through a recent podcast episode of yours about the gamma wave entrainment studies on mice in reducing amyloid and tau proteins. In that episode, you said that you wouldn't be surprised if some enterprising company developed gadgets to mimic the tools used in that study. I did a little Googling and discovered that, sure enough, those devices exist. I ordered both a light and a sound device from a company called Gamma Light Therapy through Amazon and wanted to issue my experience as a warning to your listeners. This, my friends, is a one-star review. The audio device arrived first, and I tried it for 5 minutes. Rather than a 40 hertz sound wave, which is inaudible to most of us, the device plays a 1 kilohertz sound wave pulsed at 40 cycles per second. It sounds like a mini jackhammer. Oops, I guess they didn't read the article carefully. I have long suffered from minor tinnitus, and the effect of the sounds from this device was to exaggerate the ringing sound in my ears, or more accurately, my brain, but it didn't linger and I didn't give it a second thought. I received the lights the next day and tried those for 20 minutes without issue. Then I tried the sound device again for 10 minutes, and this time the amplification of my tinnitus was unmistakable and bad enough to be a problem. That was nearly 30 hours ago, and it has not let up. A key to dealing with persistent tinnitus is to ignore it, attending to it typically increasing the impact it has to distract and annoy one's mind. But the level of tinnitus the gamma wave device has left me with is beyond my ability to ignore it. It is headache-inducing and so distracting as to be truly worrying. I wanted to quickly write to you in the hopes of sparing anyone else who might be in danger of incurring the same symptom. If you notice your ears ringing after using a gamma wave or any binaural tone device, discontinue it immediately. You don't want a chance of creating a chronic issue. I would also welcome any feedback or advice you have on addressing this predicament. My current plan is to arrange to get a brain mapping performed and see if there isn't a countervalent frequency that might afford me relief. He cites a study, which I haven't had a chance to look at, but which looks very interesting, just based on the title. And I'll get back to you with that study later sometime in the program. So thank you so much. Let's go to our next email. That is from Sybil. Sybil writes, vitamin overdose. Dear Dr. Don, in a German magazine I am reading, many people overdose with vitamins. With the title, Vitamins Essential But Can Be Dangerous, they write, too much vitamin A can have toxic levels. Does the same go for beta carotene? And there's a whole list of questions about nutritional toxicity here, so I'm going to take them one by one. So the first one was vitamin A having toxic levels. And then there's a, and I want to talk about that in some detail. beta carotene is a form of vitamin A that is water soluble. It is very harmless, and in fact, large amounts of beta carotene pills are taken by some people to give themselves a fake tan because the compound deposits in the skin and gives you kind of a orangey tan. The next question, but vitamin A itself can have substantial toxicity. And the toxicity comes from primarily effects on the liver, where it tends to accumulate. It takes the second and more important toxicity of vitamin A is that it's fairly low levels, levels that could be achieved by someone taking, say, over-the-counter medication for preventing a cold. You could potentially get above 8,000 units of, or above 20,000 units of vitamin A. That's considered a toxic level and a birth defect inducing level. So women who are on vitamin A need to be very careful not to go to a toxic. Agree. There was a product that's called Airborne, if I remember the name correctly, that has about 8,000 units of vitamin A in it. So, and you can, the package says you can take this up to four times a day. So that would be getting you into close to the toxic levels if you actually did that, a level which could induce birth defects if you were pregnant, so particularly first trimester. So that's something to consider. But it's really, really hard to get enough vitamin A without hyper supplementing. And most supplements do have beta carotene. There are people who lack the enzyme to convert beta carotene to vitamin A, and they have to take vitamin A themselves. As it happens, I'll share with you that I am a heterozygote for that. I don't worry too much as I eat a lot of beta, of yellow and orange vegetables and fruits, so I am getting plenty, and even my wimpy enzymes are able to keep my levels quite adequate. Too much B6 can result in lung cancer, especially in men. Too much B6 can be a problem. I don't think that the lung cancer study can really be validated, and we'll be talking about why cancer studies are generally overblown and why it can't be generalized to the general population. Too much vitamin B3 as well as folic acid can cause nerve damage. Too much of many things can actually cause nerve damage, and many of the compounds, that, particularly antibiotics and other drugs. So I looked that up and found doses that were very, very high. And I think it's a bad idea to megadose one B vitamin without, and when I say megadose, we're talking about levels that are hundreds, even thousands of times above what you're going to get in a multivitamin. So you can't really megadose in food, no matter how much food you eat. And you'd have to be taking multiple, like 10 to 100 multivitamins a day to do that with those kinds of doses. I have seen very high doses of like vitamin K and things like that, and don't think that that's particularly useful. You know, there are products out there that you can hurt yourself with, but they're definitely a minority. Too much vitamin E can be stored in the liver and become toxic. That's true, but the levels are extremely difficult to achieve. Too much vitamin D can cause damage to the heart, lungs, and kidneys. Yes, that's based on a study of people who had damage to their heart, lungs, and kidneys after getting stuck in the Arctic and surviving on polar bear liver for a long time. It takes massive amounts of vitamin E to do that. Doses of up to 10,000 a day for a year, 10,000 units a day for a year might get you up into the mid-100s, and that's when you start to see evidence of damage to the tissues. A dose of 4,000 IU a day indefinitely is considered safe by the very conservative Institute of Medicine. Let's see. Too much vitamin K can get to toxic levels. Well, if you're taking if you're taking 10,000 micrograms a day, you might do it. All of the vitamin D K toxicity I could find was related to synthetic vitamin K given by injection, and also vitamin K toxicity when infants got synthetic vitamin K at high levels because someone blew it on the dosing. All infants get a small dose of vitamin K at birth if they're born in a hospital. This has to do with the fact that vitamin K is made by bacteria, and infants, for the most part, don't have a microbiome. Sybil continues, I've stopped taking a multivitamin because I'm afraid I've achieved toxic levels by eating lots of vegetables, pumpkins, fruits, and taking a multivitamin. Sybil, you haven't. Start taking your multivitamin. I'm especially concerned about B12 since, despite good absorption, I showed off the chart high levels. I thought I was taking too much with 1,000 micrograms every day. I've since cut down to 1,000 micrograms three times a week. That's a big dose of vitamin D, B12, probably way more than you need. But I always, when I see very high vitamin B levels, I check methylmalonic acid, because if that's elevated, it means that you have a mutation that doesn't let your body use B12, and you're building it up because you can't use it. That's probably also why you see some cases of folic acid toxicity. People who have the MTHFR mutation and can't process their folic acid will have very high blood levels, and we think that that might be dangerous for them. And I'm going to take a quick question. This was from Carrie in Santa Cruz. I have seborrheic dermatitis on scalp and skin. Is there an emotional aspect? Any advice you can give? Well, definitely the emotions can affect the skin. Some people, it's very evident. Seborrheic dermatitis typically comes on with aging, and can be, it's typically shown in the eyebrows, the hairline. You'll also sometimes, if a man has facial hair, see it there, or in the sideburns, although sideburns have kind of gone the way of vested leisure suit. But the other advice I would have for seborrheic dermatitis is, little known secret, it actually responds really well to either a dilute formula of tea tree oil. And when I say dilute, I'm talking maybe the commercial tea tree oil that you buy, about one part of that oil to about 10 parts water. Just sprayed on the areas daily. It isn't oily enough to really affect your hair. It isn't particularly stingy on your eyes if any gets in. So that works well. You can use a topical antifungal, and that also works well. Somehow, a change in the skin microbiome involving a fairly harmless yeast is a piece of the seborrheic dermatitis puzzle, and this dilute tea tree oil seems to alter the microbiome in a different way. Okay, so another question about supplements. This is from Patricia in Santa Cruz. Came across this article about magnesium and possible overdosing. I was particularly interested in what it said about lethargy, muscle weakness, and electrical problems in the heart. They recommend men not take more than 420 milligrams a day, and women not more than 320 milligrams a day. That seems pretty low to me. I take 800 spread over the day. They do say that overdosing is rare, but I wonder what you think about that. Here's a link to the article. Well, I looked at the article, and I wanted to say that it was kind of terrible. It was written by a layperson with a computer, someone who has no understanding of physiology, no understanding of how biology in living creatures actually works, who went around and sort of cherry-picked statements, and because they take the statements out of context, they're mostly completely inaccurate. So I'm not going to perpetuate what it said that was wrong. I'm going to tell you how things actually work in clinical medicine. You do not see any symptoms of problems with oral magnesium at doses less than 5,000 milligrams a day. Now, I have never seen anybody manage 5,000 milligrams a day orally, because the body has its own mechanism and its own limits in how much magnesium it will absorb. And when you put more than what the body can absorb, it acts as an excellent laxative. Have you heard of milk of magnesia, anybody out there? Well, that's what this is, a high dose of magnesium that gives you the runs or gives you makes you poop if you're stuck. The fact that it causes these things, lethargy, muscle weakness, and electrical problems in the heart, is absolutely true. I was taught about that when I was doing labor and delivery during my medical training. One of the common drugs that we used to prevent preterm labor or to try to stop preterm labor back in the 80s was magnesium sulfate. It was given intravenously. It still is. And the doses, just to give you a sense for how much magnesium the human body, and I will also point out, these were women who then went on to deliver perfectly normal babies, extensively studied, no problems with doing this to the mom or to the babies. The standard dosing is 4 grams, that's 4,000 milligrams IV push, and then a titration up to 5 grams or 5,000 milligrams an hour, every hour, for 24 to 48 hours. And you're allowed to give more if you're not getting anywhere with that dosing, but then you're switching to a high, what is considered a higher risk dosing because of the cardiac. Now, it doesn't take a lot of potassium to stop your heart, but it takes a ton of magnesium, more than it's realistically possible to imagine anyone getting in to their body unless someone turned on a magnesium drip all the way open and just let the thing roll wide open, liter after liter. It's just not a thing. So I would say that anyone suffering from lethargy, muscle weakness, and or electrical problems in the heart needs to look elsewhere. And this is the problem when you go online and look for health advice. This is a very disappointing article because of the way it's written. It's scare tactics. What you're doing is wrong. I'm assuming that this site had ads. And all I can say is, if you go to a site and it has ads, you need to take a deep breath, copy 3 or 4 lines from one of the paragraphs and put that in your browser. See if there's a match in a half a dozen other sites. And if there are, disregard the thing entirely. This is just a cut and paste construction designed to provide fake and inaccurate content to get you to read it so that they get ad revenue. Doesn't mean that everything that has ads is bad, but it does mean that if you can find the same paragraph in other sites, that's not original material, and the other sites are probably also kind of bogus. So that's what I mean. For me, that's one. If you do that in a science site, it's called attribution, and it will be referenced. It will not be taken as their own content. It will be in italics or something, or quotes. They don't do that. They're just putting together a cut and paste content so that they can have something to post. Our next email from Tim in Funk. I'm not sure where Funk is or if it is, but Tim, if your location is Funk and it's not a real location, then I must say it's an excellent place to be. This article from the HawaiianReporter.com. Beef over red meat advice reveals medical corruption. This one really bugged me. It felt, again, like a political rant. Unfortunately, the article that they are ranting against, which apparently said that humans should continue eating the current unprocessed amount of red meat and the current amount of processed red meat. It was obviously a meta study. That is to say, where multiple studies are put together and evaluated. The medical community was apparently very defensive. That's the charge that's being made here. And I think what this is a paleo guy or who's saying that this study supports paleo and high meat diet, and all of those medical recommendations about lowering saturated fat are wrong. And this is probably not, and we should just ignore 20 years of medical science. Well, I think that the meta study is something that, if are a regular listener to this program, you understand that it can be gamed. And I'm not sure these people gamed it. I also know that when you put multiple studies together, either you put all the studies together or you leave some out. And if you leave some out, then you're biasing your study. And then one is sort of depending upon the veracity of the people who did the case selection, that they only threw out bad science and didn't pay any attention to the conclusions and throw out studies that reached conclusions opposite to the one they wished to reach. It's way too gameable for us to ever take a meta study and rely on it. If we have 10 meta studies done by different entities, maybe we can we could pay attention to it. But the other thing to understand about meta studies is that it violates one of the basic rules of statistics, which is you can't really generalize because you have taken a bunch of studies that were done on a small group, and now you're going to apply them to a broader, larger group. Most studies are done on men because of the potential liability of doing them on women. Many of the studies are retrospective. There's all sorts of variables that are different between people, their behaviors, their lifestyles, their genetics. And so you may get an effect if you get large enough numbers, and that's usually why meta-studies are done, is because with the smaller studies, it wasn't statistically significant. Well, a meta-study is almost never clinically significant. It's statistically significant because they finally got enough numbers together to spit out a result, but it may not be clinically significant because the number needed to treat or the number of people needed to affect is small. On the subject, which is a high red meat diet, ultimately, I'm going to come down on the side that in the long run, if you're young, it's going to be unhealthy for you. It may not be unhealthy for your body directly from its effects on your cholesterol. That's going to rely on your genetics and your other dietary components, what's your beef that you're eating ate, because believe me, corn-fed factory beef is different from a free-range wild deer. So that's a factor. And ultimately, the effect on your health is going to be from the smoke that you're going to be breathing from all of the forest fires from global warming. The effect on your health is going to be from the tropical diseases, which are now showing up in a temperate climate, like Zika and dengue and all the other things that are suddenly showing up in southern Florida and southern Texas. Those are going to just march north as the temperatures climb. Birds can fly north. People can move, but it's a little bit more difficult. And the economic consequences and hardships related to global warming are huge. So what do I see as the public health crisis of the next century? Global warming, because the impacts on public health are probably going to be more massive and more devastating than any other factor you can imagine. One last email I want to talk about. This is from Amanda in Scotts Valley. I mentioned to you we were going to loop back around to those drugs that are the calcium gene-related peptide antagonists, those monoclonal antibodies. Here's Amanda's letter. Was just scrolling through your show archives and listened to a segment from about a year ago when you recommended avoiding CGRP antagonists. Has your opinion changed? I've had a migraine with Aura for years, and in the last 2 years tried tropiramate, stopped due to moodiness and erratic behavior, and propranolol, gained 25 pounds in 3 months as daily prophylactics. My neurologist at Stanford just prescribed Emgality, which is galcinezumab, and anything, as you know, that ends in AB is a monoclonal. So my first thought for Amanda was, think about you. I don't know if you've used Feverfew, which is an herb, contains a compound called parthenolide. Off the top of my head, I don't remember the effective dose, but it's somewhere in the 1,000 milligram range. Parthenolide is only found in the Feverfew plants that are at least 3 years old. So you have to be careful when you're selecting your nutrient national, and it takes about 3 months to work. But that might be something to look into. And I also wanted to mention vitamin B6, which has been shown at high doses of like 400 milligrams to work for some people quite well as a preventative. And Botox. Yep, it's not just for wrinkles and strabismus. It actually has a pretty darn good track record for migraine prevention. So if you've got fairly frequent migraines, these might be things I would consider safer because, honestly, Botox has been around for a long time and we know what's wrong with it. Ditto for the herbs and the vitamins and many of the drugs. A new drug means you better be pretty seriously sick and really have problems that you need to treat because you are part, by definition, of a cohort of human guinea pigs. And so whenever you make a monoclonal against something, you're turning it off. And this CGRP thing is a compound that's produced in the body. It has a purpose. It is a signaling compound. And there are receptors all over the place in the blood vessels for this signaling compound. And it sends, guess what? A signal. It's part of the regulatory system that controls blood flow. That's why you're using it, right? Migraine is where the blood vessels are dilated and they're sending too much blood to the brain and your meninges are stretched and they're pounding on you. But when you go and look at what CGRP does, it's a vasodilator. Do you really want to block a vasodilator? Vasodilators are really, really important regulating blood flow. Like you might be increasing your risk of a stroke. You're certainly increasing your risk of hypertension. That's even in the package insert. You might be impairing microcirculation to the brain. This could actually have a longer term effect than is suspected because it wouldn't show up. There's no way we have right now to be measuring that short of doing MRIs in any human we give it to. And I couldn't find that the drug company had been required to do that by the FDA. So we don't know that that microcirculation to the brain is preserved, or we don't know how long it's impaired. It certainly could cause Raynaud's. It could certainly cause reperfusion injury. It could certainly worsen heart failure. And when I looked at the studies on animal tissues, I was pretty concerned about the possibility that there could be a problem with this. So I just want to suggest that you proceed with caution. Your doctor is very interested in finding out if this drug works. If you complain enough about the problem, they'll probably give it to they'll give it to you, which they have. So just be aware that you need to be severely impaired for the trade-off to be worth it, because you're trading off relief for the unknown. And it's the unknown, right? We don't even know what we don't know. And I hate to quote Bill Cheney, but that was a very, very good line and deserves to go down in history. Let's go to our next caller, and that is Francis. Hello, Francis. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thank you. I'm calling with a couple of questions. The first one is, some months back, I emailed you, and I guess I was asking about vitamin C, and you were saying that it can be very useful, the powder made into a paste to improve skin tone.
Right.
And so I purchased a box of powdered vitamin C, and then I had visions of flaking vitamin C in the bed. And
oh, no.
How and when would one apply it?
Okay, so let's talk about this little thing that women call a face mask. And the way that face masks are kind of various things. You can use egg white, you can use gooey stuff. Sometimes people go through a series of face masks. You can pay good money to go somewhere and have people smear a series of things on your skin. And it's a thing. Kind of a girl thing, but not so much. You know, it could be a boy thing too. I am merely saying that you make a paste, You could add some kind of an oily binder if you wanted. You could use mayonnaise or egg white or anything. And then you rinse. You sit there for 10 or 15 minutes with the stuff on your face, and then you rinse it off. And so that's one way to do it. Another way, which I just came across and I thought was pretty clever, was to get a moisturizing lotion, you know, I don't know, something at the local drugstore that doesn't have a whole lot, too many chemicals in it, and then add a tablespoon, or let's say you're going to use an amount on the area that's the size of a silver dollar. So, you know, two fingers across. So you'd put maybe a teaspoon measure of the vitamin C powder in that and mix it together and just rub that into your skin. And you'll probably get, and then wipe off the residual, and you'll probably get some decent penetration of the vitamin C. You have to use relatively high doses, or you have to buy really expensive products that use a doctored form of vitamin C called palmitoyl. So it's acetyl palmitoyl, has nothing to do with palm oil. So you don't necessarily want to go there because it's expensive. And so that's how you could use your powder.
Okay. Well, I wasn't thinking so much of my face, but for the forearms, because I used to get a lot of sun. And
you could do a mask and just leave it for 15 minutes, like I said, and then rinse it off. And that would probably give you a reasonable amount of vitamin C. And over time, you would start to see some structural improvement in the skin, because it does, it is a pro-collagen. It's what we call a cofactor in collagen production. And that might help with the crepiness as well as with the tendency to tear and bleed under the surface.
And this would be a daily application?
Good question. I don't know. I probably would do it as often as I could if it wasn't inconvenient. The lotion thing could work as a daily application, certainly.
Okay, well, thank you for that. The other question I had is, I'm reading a book right now entitled Elderhood, written by Dr. Louise Aronson.
Uh-huh.
She's a gerontologist at UCSF, and I'm enjoying the book very much. And, you know, of course, it raises a lot of questions. I belong to Kaiser, and when I've seen my primary care doctor, I asked him if there was a gerontology department at Kaiser, and I think he said there wasn't. And, you know, I have read that gerontologists are in very short supply across the country, and yet we have such a growing elder population. Also, I have heard that enough doctors now are trained in the feeding and care of elders in the community, and I just wanted your comment on that. I could actually take it offline.
Well, that's fine either way, Francis. Okay, so first of all, gerontology, there's not an, so far as I am aware, and I guess I could search it, but it would have to have the neck of a giraffe to manage it while still talking to you. There's levels of what it takes to call yourself something. So if you call yourself a gerontologist, officially you would have to have certification by a medical board. I have no idea how many gerontology residencies there are out there, but you would have to have gone through a specific residency and then be certified by the National Board of Gerontology. A second thing you can do is you can have a fellowship. So, for example, an interventional cardiologist is a cardiologist who is someone who has an internal medicine degree and then who went and did a fellowship in interventional cardiology. So at that point, you have a special knowledge and special skills that you were trained at this post-postgraduate level more accurately, since residency training is postgraduate school. The idea is, certification is kind of a loose term. In family medicine, we have an additional certification of geriatrics, and a lot of the people who call themselves gerontologists are actually family practice doctors or general internists who have gotten an additional certification. And this is not the same as a fellowship. It's generally a much shorter educative process. A lot of it will be online, and there'll be a exam that you have to take in order to get your additional certification. And that's felt to be enough to validate you. Basically, geriatrics is about thinking straight on the subject of the fact that humans are not one size fits all entities, that you can't use the protocols the same way that you would use the protocols, and that drugs act differently, and that the older people are, the less benefit they derive from aggressive, invasive procedures, and the more harm they receive when they get these in, less resilience. So the more harm, the higher risk these things are. So it's more a mindset than anything else. And most of the special things that you need to know, you can look up. So I feel like anyone whose primary practice, if they've done any kind of certification through one of the internal medicine or the family practice board, knows everything they really need to know to be calling themselves a gerontologist. And it's not rocket science. That's why as a family practice doctor, I'm trained in pediatrics. I'm trained in gerontology, but there's more training to be had in either of those if I were going to focus my practice. So a doctor whose practice is focused on the elders probably has the requisite experience. And I suspect if you re-ask the question at Kaiser, which of the primary care doctors do you have whose primary focus is in an older patient base, you would find someone who had that expertise that you're looking for. You may just have to actually ask the question a little differently.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I just want to share one last thing with you. My producer went searching. He was able to, he didn't have to twist his neck around quite so far. And he tells me that you can get a certificate in gerontology after 25 hours of classes. Now, that's a little fly by night, but that gives you a sense for how loose that terminology is.
Mm-hmm. I know I've heard as far as underwriters, or maybe it's a promotional for the, I guess it's UCLA School of Gerontology, and I suppose there's a variety of different certification levels that one could acquire.
Well, the best thing to do is to find out if that School of Gerontology is focused on training clinicians and whether they have a hospital rotations. That would be really key. All right. Well,
all right.
Best of luck to you.
Thank
and
you
thanks
so
for the
much.
Call.
All right. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Going to go to Fred in Santa Cruz. Oh. Hi.
And the guy had a, give me a drink, and it's called Stevia.
Right.
And it says filtered water, erythritol, maltodextrin, natural flavors, citric acid, malic acid, and stevia leaf extract.
Right.
And he said, oh, it's all fine stuff because everything's zero fat, zero sodium, zero carbs, zero protein. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. It's a little weird taste. What do you think about stevia and erythritol?
Okay. Well, what do I think about them? In particularly the erythritol, let me take that one first. You're a little staticky, so I'm going to pot you down while I give the response, but I'll come back up when
I'm done. I'll put my phone down.
All right, fine. So basically, erythritol is a sugar alcohol, and this compound is a sugar-like molecule. It looks very much like sugar, except it has an OH group on it that makes it an alcohol. And it can't be absorbed by the human digestive tract because the molecule just can't be broken down by the enzymes. So as a result, this remains in your gut. It leaves a sweet taste on your tongue. It is, however, something that many of the bacteria in your gut are quite happy to eat. And as a side effect of the digestion of sugar alcohols, you can get gas and you can get diarrhea. So this is a compound that in small amounts is fine. There are some like diabetic candies that use sugar alcohol. And I used to get patients who were diabetic coming in with diarrhea. And one of the questions I always had to remember to ask them is, you know, are you using xylitol or are you doing a lot of diabetic candy? Because that's a common cause of, let's call it food-induced diarrhea. It's a malabsorption syndrome. The stuff acts like a laxative. So the other question about stevia, it starts out as an organic product. It's actually a plant, and the leaf, when you chew up the leaf or crush it, tastes sweet. And because it's a natural compound, I always think that things that grow on trees are safer. The problem with stevia is in the processing. So if you're getting something that is just pure powdered leaf or an extract that doesn't have any other chemicals in it, I think that's fine. I generally, I don't know what was in that drink specifically. There can be some things that come in industrial or in the industrial production of a liquid stevia extract that could be a problem if consumed in large amounts. That being said, your alternative is sugar, sugar-sweetened beverages, which, you know, definitely have adverse health effects. Does your gut and expect something different when it tastes sugar in the mouth and then doesn't get sugar in the gut? You bet. And there are some suggestions that even artificial sugars or artificial sweeteners can contribute, particularly in high doses, to glucose resistance, insulin resistance, more accurately. So overall, I think that moderation is the key here. It's a little bit like before we learned how dangerous vaping was, you could make the argument that you were safer because the vape didn't contain the tar. It contained the nicotine, but it didn't contain the tar and the combustion products that were in the tobacco leaf. Now we know that the combustion products in the vape liquid are potentially even worse than cigarette smoking. And so there's always the law of unintended consequences with any kind of artificial sweetener. And ultimately, I think just training your taste buds using spa water, maybe squeezing some lemon or some lemon and cucumber into a beverage and letting it sit for a while to give it some flavor is a better alternative. Or just using berries, you know, and mushing them a little bit and dumping them in the bottle. So learn to train your taste buds by suppressing the amount of sugar or sweeteners that you use. Your taste buds will actually become more adept at tasting natural sweetness that is in something like mint or cinnamon. And you'll find that the sort of brass band effect, I certainly notice that with any kind of Christmas candy or Christmas dessert now. I took one bite and it's like, oh my God, this is yelling at me. I do small amounts of stevia in my tea, and that's pretty much it for sweets. And over years, my taste buds have really come back online when it comes to tasting natural sweetness. So I can assure you, if you make the change and you get through the first 6 months or so, you're going to find that you actually like it and that it improves your life experience. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.